Chapter 4. Less than an hour after Pitt alerted the Numa research vessel Ice Hunter, Captain Paul Dempsey braved an icy breeze and watched as Giordino hovered the helicopter above the ship's landing pad. Except for the ship's cook busily preparing hot meals in the galley, and the chief engineer, who remained below, the entire crew, including lab technicians and scientists, had turned out to greet the first group of cold and hungry tourists to be airlifted from Seymour Island. Captain Dempsey had grown up on a ranch in the Beartooth Mountains astride the Wyoming-Montana border. He ran away to sea after graduating from high school and worked the fishing boats out of Kodiak, Alaska. He fell in love with the icy seas above the Arctic Circle and eventually passed the examination to become captain of an ice-breaking salvage tug. No matter how high the seas or how strong the wind, Dempsey never hesitated to take on the worst storms the Gulf of Alaska could throw at him after he'd received a call from a ship in distress. During the next 15 years, his daring rescues of innumerable fishing boats, 6 coastal freighters, 2 oil tankers, and a Navy destroyer created a legend that resulted in a bronze statue beside the dock at Seward, a source of great embarrassment to him. Forced into retirement when the ocean-going salvage company became debt-ridden, he accepted an offer from the chief director of NUMA, Admiral James Sandecker, to captain the agency's polar research ship, Ice Hunter. Dempsey's trademark, a chipped briar pipe, jutted from one corner of his tight but good-humored mouth. He was a typical tugman, broad-shouldered and thick-waisted, habitually standing with legs wide set. Yet he presented a distinguished appearance. Gray-haired, clean-shaven, a man given to telling good sea stories, Dempsey might have been taken for a jovial captain of a cruise ship. He stepped forward as the wheels of the chopper settled onto the deck. Beside him stood the ship's physician, Dr. Mose Greenberg. Tall and slender, he wore his dark brown hair in a ponytail. His blue-green eyes twinkled, and he had about him that certain indefinable air of trustworthiness common to all conscientious, dedicated doctors around the world. Dr. Greenberg, along with 4 crewmen bearing stretchers for any of the elderly passengers who found it difficult to walk on their own, ducked under the revolving rotor blades and opened the rear cargo door. Dempsey moved toward the cockpit and motioned to Giordino to open the side window. The stocky Italian obliged and leaned out. "Is Pitt with you?" asked Dempsey loudly above the swoosh of the blades. Giordino shook his head. "He and Van Fleet stayed behind to examine a pack of dead penguins." "How many of the cruise ship's passengers were you able to carry?" "We squeezed in 6 of the oldest ladies who had suffered the most. 4 more trips ought to do it. 3 to transport the remaining tourists and 1 to bring out Pitt, Van Fleet, the guide, and the 3 dead bodies they stashed in an old whaler's rendering shed." Dempsey motioned into the miserable mixture of snow and sleet. "Can you find your way back in this soup?" "I plan to beam in on Pitt's portable communicator." "How bad off are these people?" "Better than you might expect for senior citizens who've suffered 3 days and nights in a frigid cave. Pitt said to tell Dr. Greenberg that pneumonia will be his main worry. The bitter cold has sapped the older folks' energy, and in their weakened condition their resistance is real low." "Do they have any idea what happened to their cruise ship?" asked Dempsey. "Before they went ashore, their excursion guide was told by the first officer that the ship was heading 20 kilometers up the coast to put off another group of excursionists. That's all she knows. The ship never contacted her again after it sailed off." Dempsey reached up and lightly slapped Giordino on the arm. "Hurry back, and mind you don't get your feet wet." Then he moved around to the cargo door and introduced himself to the tired and cold passengers from the Polar Queen as they exited the aircraft. He tucked a blanket around the 83-year-old woman, who was being lifted to the deck on a stretcher. "Welcome aboard," he said with a warm smile. "We have hot soup and coffee and a soft bed waiting for you in our officers' quarters."
"If it's all the same to you,"
she said sweetly. "I'd prefer tea." "Your wish is my command, dear lady," Dempsey said gallantly. "Tea it is." "Bless you, Captain," she replied, squeezing his hand. As soon as the last passenger had been helped across the helicopter pad, Dempsey waved off Giordino, who immediately lifted the craft into the air. Dempsey watched until the turquoise craft dissolved and vanished into the white blanket of sleet. He relit the ever-present pipe and tarried alone on the helicopter pad after the others had hurried back into the comfort of the ship's superstructure to get out of the cold. He had not counted on a mission of mercy, certainly not one of this kind. Ships in distress on ferocious seas he could understand. But ships' captains who abandoned their passengers on a deserted island under incredibly harsh conditions, he could not fathom. The Polar Queen had sailed far more than 25 kilometers from the site of the old whaling station. He knew that for certain. The radar on Ice Hunter's Bridge could see beyond 120 kilometers, and there was no contact that remotely resembled a cruise ship. The gale had slackened considerably by the time Pitt, along with Maeve Fletcher and Van Fleet, reached the Penguin Rookery. The Australian zoologist and the American biologist had become friendly almost immediately. Pitt walked behind them in silence as they compared universities and colleagues in the field. Maeve plagued Van Fleet with questions pertaining to her dissertation, while he queried her for details concerning her brief observation of the mass decimation of the world's most beloved bird. The storm had carried the carcasses of those nearest the shoreline out to sea, but by Pitt's best calculation, a good 40,000 of the dead birds still lay scattered amid the small stones and rocks, like black and white gunny sacks filled with wet grain. With the easing of the wind and sleet, visibility increased to nearly a kilometer. Giant petrels, the vultures of the sea, began arriving to feast upon the dead penguins. Majestic as they soared gracefully through the air, they were merciless scavengers of meat from any source. As Pitt and the others watched in disgust, the huge birds quickly disemboweled their lifeless prey, forcing their beaks inside the penguin carcasses until their necks and heads were red with viscera and gore. "Not exactly a sight I care to remember," said Pitt. Van Fleet was stunned. He turned to Maeve, his eyes unbelieving. "Now that I see the tragedy with my own eyes, I find it hard to accept so many of the poor creatures dying within such a concentrated space in the same time period." "Whatever the phenomenon," said Maeve, "I'm certain it also caused the death of my two passengers and the ship's crewmen who brought us ashore." Van Fleet knelt and studied one of the penguins. "No indication of injury, no obvious signs of disease or poison. The body appears fat and healthy." Maeve leaned over his shoulder. "The only nonconformity that I found was the slight protrusion of the eyes." "Yes, I see what you mean. The eyeballs seem half again as large." Pitt looked at Maeve thoughtfully. "When I was carrying you to the cave, you said the three who died did so under mysterious circumstances." She nodded. "Some strange force assaulted our senses, unseen and non-physical. I have no idea what it was. But I can tell you that for at least a full 5 minutes it felt like our brains were going to explode. The pain was excruciating." "From the blue coloring on the bodies you showed me in the rendering shed," said Van Fleet, "the cause of death appears to be cardiac arrest." Pitt stared over the scene of so much annihilation. "Not possible that three humans, countless thousands of penguins, and 50 or more leopard seals all expired together from a heart condition." "There must be an interrelating cause," said Maeve. "Any connection with the huge school of dolphins we found out in the Weddell Sea, or the pot of seals washed up just across the channel on Vega Island, all deader than petrified wood?" Pitt asked Van Fleet. The marine biologist shrugged. "Too early to tell without further study. There does, however, appear to be a definite link." "Have you examined them in your ship's laboratory?" asked Maeve. "I've dissected 2 seals and 3 dolphins and found no hook I can hang a respectable theory on. The primary consistency seems to be internal hemorrhaging, Dolphins, seals, birds, and humans, Pitt said softly. They're all vulnerable to this scourge. Van Fleet nodded solemnly. Not to mention the vast numbers of squid and sea turtles that have washed ashore throughout the Pacific, and the millions of dead fish found floating off Peru and Ecuador in the past 2 months. If it continues unstopped, there is no predicting how many species of life above and under the sea will become extinct. Pitt turned his gaze toward the sky at the distant sound of the helicopter. So, what do we know except that our mystery plague kills every living thing in air and liquid without discrimination? All within a matter of minutes, added Maeve. Van Fleet came to his feet. He appeared badly shaken. If we don't determine whether the cause is from natural disturbances or human intervention of some kind, and do it damn quick, we may be looking at oceans devoid of all life. Not just oceans. You're forgetting this thing also kills on land, Maeve reminded him. I don't even want to dwell on that horror. For a long minute, no one said a word, each trying to comprehend the potential catastrophe that lay somewhere in and beyond the sea. Finally, Pitt broke the silence. It would appear, he said, a pensive look on his craggy face, that we have our work cut out for us.